What's up, clinical problem solvers? This is Robbie. R&R are really, really excited to be back on the main podcast this week and wanted to let you know that the format of these episodes is a little different. We're going to have the core episode followed by our recap. So make sure to finish the episode and then to hear our reflections on the episode. This is the format that we use on rlrcpsolvers.com, where we, Reza and I, present cases to each other, and we do so much more frequently. We do so about 8 times more frequently than we hop onto the main podcast, and we also, on the subsequent week, reflect on the case and extract as much learning as we can. We're here on the main podcast to be able to share our love of medicine and learning with you all. And if this is something you really enjoy, highly, highly recommend you check out rlrcpsolvers.com. For about $3 a week, you can get 8 times more content in terms of the episodes and the recaps, and infinitely more teaching videos, schemas, and whatnot. So if you're really, really enjoying the space, consider checking it out. A particular note, if you are a student or an international medical graduate, email us at theclinicalproblemsolvers@gmail.com for information on a 50% discount. So thank you for taking your time to listen to RR. We hope you enjoy the episode, but make sure to finish the episode out and then tune in for the case reflection thereafter. And if you want much, much more of this stuff, to really take your clinical reasoning to the next level, consider subscribing to rlrcpsolvers.com. If you have any questions, email us at theclinicalproblemsolvers@gmail.com. Thanks, y'all.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome. You will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, Robbie John.
Woo! What about everybody else, Prof. Rez?
Focus is you, my friend. It's always you.
I'm so flattered and honored. So let's turn the recording off and just hang out. Wait, something happened to your mic, Prof. Rez. Did you unplug it or something?
Oh my gosh. 1 second, guys.
Take your time. In the meantime, I'll tell the audience that I missed you. That we're thrilled to be back for yet another episode, and that I'm realizing that I am really hard at small talk when it's just me, Prof. Rez.
Can I tell you a story? By the way, does the mic sound...
Now you sound like Prof. Rez of old.
Dude, so I already texted you and Aaron Berkowitz this story, but
yes.
I
will
share it with our audience members because it is a testament to how terrific... RLR is, if I may say so myself.
Well, yes.
Honestly, like, it was really interesting. So I am on service right now, and I'm carrying the code pager and the rapid response pager. And suddenly a rapid response goes off in the ICU. So I walk up to the ICU, and I get there, and I start asking what's going on. And they're like, oh, the patient had sudden onset diplopia. And I looked at the patient. I said, are you having double vision? She's like, yes. Quickly, I said, cover your right eye. Has it resolved? She said, yes, it's gone away. I said, okay, cover your left eye. Has it resolved? She said, yes. And at this point, there's 20 people watching me. So imagine you're like doing a performance in front of an audience. So then I looked at her extraocular movements and I noticed that her right eye did an abduct, but all other movements were okay. Up, down. So then I framed it as horizontal binocular diplopia with the lesion of the lateral rectus muscle on the right eye, which links to cranial nerve 6 or the abducens nerve. And then suddenly I thought of that episode of the microinfarction diabetes that we had presented to Aaron. And in the background, one of the neuro prelims was like, oh, she's admitted with myasthenia gravis. So then I said, okay, everyone, are you okay if we don't activate a code stroke and she's being admitted and treated for myasthenia and we say this is likely due to a neuromuscular junction disorder and call neurology who's following her care to see if they agree or if they want us to activate the code stroke? And everyone was in agreement. So then I popped out of the room and I went to the ICU attending who I had met at a party a few weeks ago at one of my friend's house. I was like, hey, Russell. So this patient basically has a cranial nerve 6 palsy on the right. It's likely the neuromuscular junction, nothing to do. Any questions? he's like, no, I said, thank you. And then I quickly texted Robbie and Aaron. And look, when I left that scene, I got almost tearful, not because of genius or intelligence, but because of how much I struggled with neurology and how through hard work and reflection and these episodes and working on figures, I told the team, like, man, I spent 15 hours thinking about horizontal diplopia, that I was able in 30 seconds to avoid a code stroke, localize the lesion, and move on. That's the power of RLR and reflection.
The third R, RLR. By the way, I said L 4 times instead of R 4 times, so I butchered that. But I was going to say that I can't think of a more fitting story than to the 1-year anniversary of our child, RLRSleepDisorders.com. Yes, it's been exactly a year and 2 days since we launched ProfRes. And I think our growth has been unreal. Like, I've never grown so much clinically in my life than this last year. There's no doubt about that. And I think that, you know, we're the principal subscribers, like having to create the content. And most of the time we re-listen to it and rehearse it and prep it has just been so, so rewarding. And so, yeah, ProfRes, I'm not surprised. I think you'll have many, many more stories like that. And you're right. It's not due to intelligence at all. I'm kidding. It's due to the abundance of intelligence. But I'm going to tell you, you're going to need all your muscles today, all of them. And that's in large part because your patient doesn't seem to have any. She's 23. And she, first glance of her is in a wheelchair in the triage room. And what I see is a young, frail looking, very, very kind of like ill appearing woman. She's there with her partner. And she says, for the last 5 days, she's been feeling horrible, really bad myalgias, high fevers, nausea, and vomiting. I'll stop there for now.
Wow. So, Robbie, this is very concerning. You have a young patient who is looking like an elderly, cachectic individual with fevers and myalgias. And, you know, with young individuals, we always think about bad luck, bad genetics, and risky behavior. Here, there's no reason to suspect bad luck, like an accident or trauma. And we'll definitely explore risky behaviors, which may put her at risk of HIV or chronic infections that can cause such devastation. But we really want to put our focus here on bad genetics. And by bad genetics, probably a better term is unlucky genetics. We'll come back to that, but we'll track that. And the main problem we're solving here is primarily an inflammatory muscle issue. And this is all based on what you told us. Inflammatory because of the fever, muscle issues because of what seems to be a lot of atrophy of the muscle, and myalgia. Myalgia is quite specific. If you step back, could the patient be misrepresenting this and it's more superficial? Not really. Like, people know when their muscles hurt. And this is at rest that she's having pain. So we don't have to invoke angina to the muscle from claudication. So I'm really worried about a systemic inflammatory, and I'll leave it at myopathy because we don't know yet if there is itis, myositis, but the fever suggests that there is myositis. And already I'm priming my mind to be cautious with the CK values, because if her muscles are burned out, maybe she won't have much of a CK elevation. So I'm sending that LDH and aldolase in addition to all the inflammatory markers. So where my mind goes immediately, Robbie, is in the inflammatory myopathy, prioritizing myositis, and then thinking of autoimmune stuff, specifically polymyositis and dermatomyositis. But I'm just throwing out terms. We're going to get much more information and we'll be able to make more progress.
I have my revenge. Remember? Remember when last week you said, oh, the patient's coming with eyelid edema. And I'm like, blepharitis. And then you said, oh, no, Robbie, the patient's coming in with leg edema. And I said, heart failure. And then you said, no, Robbie, the patient's coming in with facial swelling. Well, here's my revenge, Prof. Rez. I look over. By the way, I was totally setting you up. I was looking over. I looked over the computer screen. This is, by the way, all your thoughts, I swear, crossed my mind. But I could have not paused where I paused. I chose to pause there for. And I looked over and I see. So the way it's set up is like you walk in the room and then on your left is a patient and the vital signs kind of machine. And on your right, like kind of like at the 2 o'clock position, the nurse sits and the nurse turns to her left to see the patient. I hope you imagine the scene. And there's a computer. The nurse usually has a computer screen that's open and CPRS. And so this patient's screen is very easy to see because, Prof. Rez, as you know, most of our veterans, their cover sheet, their problem list is so many problems you can't quite see which one from a distance. But she only had one. Only had one, which made sense. She's 20. She actually was a little older than a little older than 23, but I'll just keep it at 23. And she had one problem. And that problem was anorexia nervosa. And so when I saw that, I was like, okay, let me focus on the acute stuff. I bet that since that diagnosis is made, that there's been a lot of due diligence about the chronic stuff. The acute stuff was very intriguing. So she said 5 days, myalgias, nausea, vomiting, no upper respiratory symptoms, no chest symptoms, no dyspnea, no chest pain, no nothing, no abdominal symptoms except the nausea and vomiting, with specifically no diarrhea, no dysuria, no flank pain. No rash, and that's it. I'll stop there.
Wow. So nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea.
No. Nausea, vomiting, and myalgias, and everything else is negative. There's no diarrhea.
You know what's so interesting? If I did a quick cognitive autopsy, even in that first aliquot of information, you said she's coming in with 5 days of symptoms. No one in 5 days can lose that much muscle mass. So you know that there is probably a chronic issue. Now, whether it's a flare-up of that chronic issue or whether it's unrelated, that's to be determined. But anorexia nervosa, you know, would be a very good explanation for someone appearing extremely frail. And you might ask the question, how does this affect our analysis of the current foreground of the clinical syndrome? How does it affect it? Well, if someone is not taking in nutrition, they're likely to be vitamin deficient, and they're likely to be immunocompromised from nutritional deficiency. So right away, with the tempo that you've presented, Robbie, we have to consider infection, and she would be at risk of infection because of her protoplasm and her severe malnourishment. Of course, we're going to get vitals and her BMI and her weight, but already my mind is thinking of that. With regard to the 5 days, so the tempo is acute. It's not hyperacute. When you have an acute tempo, you really prioritize infection and even non-infectious inflammatory processes. But infection really takes the center stage. And then you say, well, where might that inflammation be coming from? You go into the GI tract, but you have to be cautious there because this nausea and vomiting, could she have a gastritis? Possible. But as the duration of symptoms progress and the fact that she has myalgias, it's hard for me to directly zoom in on the GI tract and say, oh, this is a non-specific bacteria or virus causing her to have some gastritis, or she had a bad egg. No, she didn't have a bad egg. It wouldn't last for 5 days. And it's unlikely that gastritis alone is explaining her clinical presentation. The more interesting finding actually is the myalgias, because myalgias, it can be myalgias. I'm already struggling with this case. I don't need you heckling me in the chat box, Robbie.
with voice, with chat, with everything. I'm coming at you, Robert.
Maybe one day we'll share the story about the egg. But basically, Robbie wrote, it was a tough egg to crack. And I'll tell you guys, there's a story about the egg that involves Gurpreet Dhaliwal, a pencil, and 30 drawings of an egg in a biliary tract, I think, or portal tract or somewhere. I don't even remember. But so for me, Robbie, right away, I am going to be interested in the vital signs. It's too nonspecific for me to make much more progress. I think the myalgia is unique. I don't want to blame a virus just yet. I'm very interested in the musculoskeletal exam. I'm going to be very interested in the labs. And patients with anorexia, there could be overlap with bulimia, I imagine. I don't know those diseases extremely well, but I would be looking at her fingernails, her dentition, making sure she's not inducing emesis. And I would actually, in this patient, also assess just her psychiatric perspective. True, might not be related to the current presentation, but I want to make sure there isn't risk for, you know, severe or grave disability, to be frank.
I absolutely love it. Let me give you all that data. So vital signs first. Her temperature is 101.5. Her heart rate is 120. Her respiratory rate, oxygen saturation are normal. I estimate her BMI to be around 17. And her exam is completely unremarkable with evidence of with the exception of her cachexia. She had clear lungs. She had a soft, non-tender belly. She had no flank pain. She had no rash. She had no neck stiffness. And she had no pharyngeal erythema. I'll stop there.
Super helpful in that we have fever. I said fever, not hyperthermia, because she's coming in with myalgias and other symptoms. Isn't on any medications that would cause drug-induced hyperthermia. And I don't think it's an issue with temperature homeostasis. Fever, inflammation, infection, autoimmune cancer. As the time progresses, autoimmune, especially in a young patient like this, will take more of the stage. But once you think of infection, you're like, okay, let me localize, what are her symptoms? And the only symptoms she has is muscle and upper GI tract. And the upper GI tract can just be a bystander. And the muscle, it would be odd to have diffuse myalgias and have a local muscle process like pyomyositis or a muscle abscess. So in a patient like this, what's going to be really helpful is getting a series of lab and seeing, is there a signature of this inflammatory process anywhere else? So looking at the liver chemistry test, looking at the kidney functions, getting a chest x-ray, the UA is not going to be the answer here, but also analyzing the AST, the CK, and seeing if there's markers of muscle inflammation. In a patient like this, you will definitely do a COVID swab and you would do a flu swab because viruses, often we've all had a viral syndrome. You get myalgias and the tempo is good. The timing is good of the season. So I would do the comprehensive respiratory viral panel for sure. And I would do a urine tox screen. I think that's very important in such a patient. And then I would let the early labs guide my next steps. I want a CBC, a CMP, a CK, chest x-ray, and those will help navigate, and the respiratory viral panel, the next steps in my evaluation of this patient.
Prof. Raz, this is one of my favorite cases because I can't tell you how fascinating this journey was to capture their thoughts in each kind of junction. And this is completely artificial. The next junctions are authentic and real and all about when the tests come back. So I sent all those tests and I'll just tell you the first things that come back at our institution are the labs, then the viral. So labs are usually about an hour. The viral swabs are a little bit after that in general. So her CBC, renal panel, LFTs were the first things to come. CBC, renal panel, LFTs, lactate, and liver enzymes were all normal, except her white count was 12. So the basic stuff is all normal. And then at our institution, you can't order a full respiratory viral panel until you have a negative rapid COVID, RSV, and influenza. So you have to order that first. So an hour and 15 minutes into her stay, she has a white count. I know that she has a white count of 12, and I know that her COVID, RSV, and influenza are negative. So, of course, I add on the respiratory viral panel, but I'd love for your thoughts at this juncture.
Yeah, this is really helpful. And I imagine, Robbie, that the diff on that white count was not funky.
Yeah, it was slightly neutrophilic.
Slightly neutrophilic. It's actually fascinating to me that someone is having an inflammatory syndrome that has been going on for 5 days, and the only marker that is abnormal is a slightly elevated white count. And by the way, we know for sure that this fever is real because her tachycardia is probably a marker of that. And just for our more junior learners, you have to be cautious with interpreting the creatinine in this context because the patient doesn't have much muscle mass. So even a normal creatinine may still be abnormal and speak to the hypovolemia or ATN in the context of inflammation. Robbie, what's going through my mind is the following, is that, boy, I don't have an answer yet. I do want, again, because of the myalgias, make sure that she's not having rhabdo or significant CK.
Sorry, I came back. It was normal. I should tell you.
It was normal. Fantastic. And one last question for you. The myalgias, is it diffuse? Like everywhere she's feeling this?
She said, her specific words, I just feel achy everywhere.
Yes, yes.
And I should be clarifying, well, she didn't have any weakness.
No
weakness. Yeah, normal.
Beautiful. And so the normal CK really, I think, lessens the likelihood of myositis. Again, we know that she doesn't have much muscle for there to be increased cell turnover. But what I would do if I were in the emergency department now is I would send an HIV test. I would send like the syphilis and really those two, HIV primarily. And I would get the comprehensive respiratory viral panel. And let me just play this. And I know you're going to give us this information. What would I do if the HIV is negative? And the, but let me, before I even comment on that, let me see what those studies showed. And then, yeah. And guide me however you're going to guide me.
I'm just going sequentially, my friend. Yes. So the next thing that happens is something that's crazy. Her heart rate, 150, 150. We get an EKG. It's sinus tachycardia. I'll stop there.
So she, something's going on. Something is, so this is really helpful. Like she was at around 120 and now she's at 150. This is good for sinus. And we have an EKG that shows sinus tach. And whenever you have sinus tachycardia, know that it almost always, it always is a physiologic response. Very important not to beta block sinus tach, because if you look at the formula, blood pressure equals cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance. Cardiac output is heart rate times stroke volume. When there's disturbances in the other parts of the formula, the body responds by increasing the heart rate. So the question becomes, why is she having sinus tachycardia? And it would be wrong to neglect the fever. So this is not just sinus tachycardia. This is fever and sinus tachycardia. Next, I would also look at her blood pressure to see if, in fact, it's normal or elevated. Because now I have to ask the question, are we dealing actually with non-inflammatory fever and sympathetic toxicity? Or are we dealing with actual inflammation-induced elevation in the temperature? So the things that would support a sympathomimetic toxicity would be an elevation in the blood pressure, would be an elevation in lactate because of the increase in metabolic rate, and would be a bit of a hypokalemia because of the catecholamine that is secreted. If you think about beta agonism, pushing K and mobilizing it into the cell. So with that elevation, the sinus tach, it tells me that either there's like some inflammatory process that I'm missing and the fever is driving the sinus tachycardia, or there's actually sympathomimetic excess or sympathetic toxicity. Another thing that would help would be hypokalemia, elevation in lactate. And in that regard, I'd be like, wait a minute, is she either having a toxin on board? But she doesn't sound, at least based on everything you said, like she has methamphetamine, cocaine, or anything that's a stimulant. Is she withdrawing from something? Like, was she someone who was on benzos and now all of a sudden she's no longer on benzos and is having a withdrawal effect? Or is there an endocrinopathy, like a thyrotoxicosis, that's causing the sinus tach and the fever through the increase in metabolic rate and impaired thermoregulation?
That's amazing, Prof. Rasu. Like, this is such an unusual case. So you're having to pivot your thoughts towards the non-infectious causes to think about acutely, hyperthyroidism, hyperthermia, which is absolutely amazing. And so you nailed it. So the reason she was so tachycardic is now her temperature was 105. This happened in the context of before the temperature was obtained, I was like, oh gosh, I have a sinus tachycardia at 105. I have no 150. I have no reason. I need to get this person to the CT scanner. And I was working on putting that scanner when the nurse comes to me and says, hey, her temperature is 105. So immediately I canceled that order and was like, okay, time for some empiric antibiotics. We can't sit on this. So, added on a TSH, gave her some antipyretics. And the next set of data then come back. TSH is normal, as is the free T4. And she actually defervesces with antipyretics. She was nauseous, so I actually couldn't give her Tylenol. So gave her IV NSAID, IV Toradol, and her fever went down to 100 in like an hour or two. And I'll stop there.
This is really fascinating. And I think it really speaks to the value of repeating vitals or repeating tests. Like if you think about it, if you had only a snapshot of tachycardia, sinus, and fever, you're running down the PE algorithm you're getting. But if you have a patient that the tachycardia is worsening and you repeat the vitals and the temperature is worsening, now you're not running towards that PE. So it tells you the power of really following and monitoring and tracking and getting updated data. And that when you just evaluate stuff in a snapshot, you're at a disadvantage. So really, I think the branch point here is this fever, which is driving everything, a consequence of cytokines and temperature elevation of the set point in the hypothalamus? Or is this elevation in temperature non-inflammatory? I think the one data point that you shared with us that's really, really powerful to suggest inflammation is that you gave an NSAID and the temperature came down. So this is really suggestive of an inflammatory cause, a fever. The only caution there is, could you have a non-inflammatory cause of elevation in temperature, like a drug-induced fever that is just going through its usual like up and down of temperature, that it's like not related and it's just a coincidence that it would have gone down whether you gave this medication or not. But because the more likely scenario is that the NSAIDs help reduce the cytokines, reducing the temperature set point, reducing the fever, we're back to like, why inflammation? And we think this patient has anorexia nervosa, is quite cachectic, is young. So it's really important to know their HIV status. And if this has been going on for 5 days and she has myalgias and waiting for the comprehensive respiratory viral panel, but I'm already thinking to myself, do I need to get a CT scan? Just not to look for a PE, but to look to see if there's like some kind of abscess, infection somewhere that I'm missing, like cross-sectional imaging, chest, abdomen, pelvis. So my next steps would be like, and even the antibiotics, I have no idea what I'm targeting and treating, honestly. Like she has the myalgia. I'm actually curious to know how you went about selecting which antibiotics to use for this patient. But yeah.
Chest beam, caspofungin, amphotericin.
I think HIV, comprehensive respiratory viral panel, and thinking about cross-sectional imaging, because I have no idea which, I'm right now leaning towards inflammatory elevation temperature fever as opposed to non-inflammatory rise in temperature hyperthermia.
Prof. Rez, you're wiser than I. I didn't even think of HIV. and I still got the diagnosis. So thank gosh. And I was like, there's only one way we're getting an answer. It's going to be with the tube of truth, but a highly suggestive diagnostic test returned. And I want the audience to try for a second to guess that in your head. And Prof. Rez, if you feel confident, feel free to say it out loud, but you don't have to say it out loud because it's silly. But if you are confident, say it out loud. Her UA came back. Takes a while to get urine in the ER. Took 3.5 hours. I remembered it. Greater than 180 white blood cells on her urinalysis with no squames. I'll stop there.
Nitrites?
Positive.
Nitrites positive. Got it. And no symptoms, urinary tract symptoms.
No dysuria, no flank pain.
So this is fascinating, folks, because I think if we rewind this 20 minutes, I was like, the UA probably wouldn't be helpful because in someone who is asymptomatic, like, what do you do? Even if there's bacteria and there's pyuria, like, we don't treat that. So let's do this exercise, folks. We have a patient who is almost acting like a patient with pyelo, but is not having any kind of symptoms of complicated urinary tract infection, be it the flank pain. So what would I do with that UA, Robbie? The nitrite positivity tells me that there's probably Enterobacteriaceae organisms, Klebsiella, E. coli, Proteus that can convert nitrate to nitrite, more specific than the leucoesterase. But I'll be honest with you, I am not confident that I'm going to ignore this because I'm not on shift anymore. Actually, yeah, I'm going to ignore it. There we go. So, because you know, I was only working until 4:30. It's 5:45. They shouldn't be calling my office. There's thank boundaries. You.
By the way, it didn't even come through. I didn't hear it. That's interesting.
You didn't hear it. Okay, perfect. All right. So Robbie, I'll be honest with you. It's hard for me to blame the urine. I can't blame the urine yet. If I'm being authentic, like I know I don't have another answer. That UA come back. So what would I do? Real time. I have a negative COVID influenza. I have pretty much a slight leukocytosis. I have someone who's at a temperature of 105. She's responding to NSAIDs. Then I have this asymptomatic nitrate positive pyuria that seems to be a good sample because there's no squames. I can't blame the UTI yet, but what this would prompt me to do is to be like, do I need to CT her abdomen and pelvis to see if there's pyelo? And then if there's evidence of perinephric stranding, and we know she doesn't have much fat, so that might affect the interpretation of the CT scan. Could the lack of fat also affect our ability to sense flank pain? Like, does that, I have no idea, but it would just be like, it would be this, Robbie, that I can't, like, in all, and I'm going to live by this, like, you cannot blame simple cystitis for this degree of inflammation. It would have to be advanced. And I cannot diagnose pyelo or complicated UTI based on a UA with no symptoms. It's not possible. And since I have no other findings, I would go for the imaging next and see if there's something going on in the kidney or the urinary tract. And then I would then go and read and be like, could the lack of fat clouded or the anorexia somehow clouded the manifestation of symptoms? I'm not too excited yet.
I think you should be, my dear, dear friend. her CT scan shows bilateral pyelonephritis. Her urine culture grows Klebsiella, and subsequently 2 out of 2 blood cultures go Klebsiella pneumoniae. She gets broad spectrum antibiotics, initially narrowed to ceftriaxone, and 4 days later is discharged from the hospital with a diagnosis of pyelonephritis. I'm curious what you think.
Oh my gosh. Before I reflect, would love your reflections on this case. And if you go back to our, like, the infection 1.0 algorithm, in that it's like, urinary, skin, lung, GI, and blood. And I think if she had come in with Rigers, it would have been a slam dunk. Man, this is a bacteremia. But to be 5 days, have no urinary symptoms, to be young. She is immunocompromised from her anorexia, but I'd love to learn, first of all, in the moment, how did you react to the UA in the moment? Like, how did you react?
Same way
and
you
then
did.
Afterwards?
I was so nervous. I was so nervous taking care of this patient who had a heart rate 150 and fever 105, and I had no idea where it was going. And I remember just being completely lost and thinking, okay, scan, scan, scan. There's just no other way. Scan, scan, scan. But we couldn't scan her until she gave urine for a pregnancy test. And so we were like kind of just stuck. And I think when the UA came back, was like, you know what? Like, this could be it. It would be incredibly unusual, but the base rate on her side. What else causes a viral swab negative high fever in a young woman? And I think that base rate is just so powerful. And there's a lot of fun reflecting and reading to do on bilateral pyelonephritis and what that entity is, who gets it, and how do they present. And I think that this is the value of the recap episodes we do in the scheme as we put that. I'll just leave that because there's so much in this case to digest. But I will tell you that, like, if you read more, which you said, which everyone should do, and if you like dissect the space, this case will make perfect sense to you. And that's the joy of what I got to do after I got the answer that I don't want to prematurely spoil for everybody else. And I want you all to go on that journey, unless you have very specific questions, Prof. Rez. But like you said yesterday on another call, like, there's something about making the learning and doing the learning yourself. But I promise you, this case, remember the features of this case. She had 5 days of symptoms. She had bilateral pyelonephritis, and I think those are interesting things to read about. But in the moment, Prof. Rez, I had never seen anything like this. I was lost. I was leaning heavily on CT scan for clarity. Initially a PE and then abdomen pelvis. And ultimately, the culture data, the imaging findings were fairly diagnostic, allowing us to have no ambiguity about what the diagnosis was, and really catapulting a lot of learning about unusual manifestations of pyelonephritis. Can patients with a ST elevation myocardial infarction come in without chest pain? Answer is yes. Can patients with pyelonephritis come in without urinary symptoms? The answer is yes. Does it have anything to do with bilateral pyelonephritis? The answer is yes. Does it have anything to do with 5 days? The answer is yes. And that's the beauty. Absolute beauty of medicine. Yeah. What did it feel like for you?
Oh man, it was I'm really excited. I'm excited to learn and reflect. It's just in real time, I think, like, it would be scary for sure. And giving the broad spectrum antibiotics, but it just still is like, I've seen bilateral pyelo, and I think it happens in like 15% of the time. We just don't image everyone, but if you do, you do get the bilateral pyelo. But the thing that, like, confuses me here is the lack of any urinary symptoms. And, like, yeah, that's really tough. But I think I'm going to read a lot more about this. But I think, like, going forward, like, if I have a patient like this where there's, like, no symptoms and is that febrile, because if you just added flank pain here, like, it would just. But this is what's so interesting about RLR, and it's like catching these patients. And, you know, and you can easily imagine someone saying, like, why would you even get a UA in this patient? We're not going to treat it. It's just going to confound it. Go look for the other reason for the fever. Don't let this trick you.
I would just emphasize one thing that that got reinforced from the reading from this case, which I think people should know now, is all the noise in urine analyses, all the asymptomatic pyuria and asymptomatic bacteria, all in older adults. For young women, she's 23, remember, she's not actually 23, but she's young. The specificity of pyuria to actionable inflammation is much higher than older adults. So that is a key fact. In fact, like, you think about what that significance of pyuria in a pregnant patient is, in large part because of the consequences of pregnancy, but also because of the lack of noise. Lack of as much noise of pyuria in younger people. These are not the patients we usually take care of. So it's very easy to merge the knowledge from the common, oh my gosh, why are we getting a UA in this older person who's confused, to like a young, healthy person. The specificity here is much higher.
I love that. I didn't even think of that. And it's incredible. So it's not only test characteristics for the general population, but test characteristic for the specific population that you're analyzing. That's wild.
Yeah. Rafraz, it was so scary to take care of this patient and reminded me of just how hard it is to practice medicine and how hard it is to try to force a patient into the textbook. And at the end of the day, it's just amazing. Thankfully, common things are common. And
so, Robs, when you saw that UA, were you like, we got the answer?
No, not at all. No, I went for the scan. I mean, the scan's not necessary at that point. Yeah. If you're confident that the patient had, like, if the patient had flank pain, I wouldn't have scanned her. There's no reason to scan her. You might scan her a day or two later if she's not getting better. But no, I went for the scan in large part because, actually, you know, to be honest, what is in the differential diagnosis with my current knowledge structure of high fevers, pyuria, is actually both intra-urinary infection, like really bad pyelo, in anyone, really bad pyelo or really bad prostatitis. But also, I think it's totally plausible for periurethral or periurinary symptoms like bad appendicitis, bad diverticulitis to cause spillover pyuria. So I don't think the diagnosis of pyelo can be confirmed with that. I think the possibility of an adjacent GI or adjacent pelvic infection irritating the urinary tract from outside would still be something important to exclude. So I think the CT scan could have showed any of those things, but base rate, you know?
Dude, and something else I think that's so striking is one that, like, when people don't have symptoms, like if there's no abdominal pain, it was like none of those processes were on my mind, like an inflammatory abdominal problem. And we know in patients with like diabetes or neuropathy, that may not have, and you're like, okay, I need a scan. They might not show their symptoms. And it was just really interesting. Like there's nothing that was, it was just some nausea, vomiting, and myalgias. And like, there was no Rigors, flank pain, no belly pain. Yeah. So it was like, these are the most difficult patients I think to care for. They look very sick, yet they're not giving you the classic frame for an illness script.
100%. I was so confident she had COVID or the flu initially, like almost like, oh, this will be a simple, she's young, healthy person. She's having myalgias and has a high fever. Like, what else could this be? I was shocked when the initial swab came back negative. And then after that.
But isn't this why you love RLR? Like all our audience members listen to this bread and butter DX, but with a really weird presentation. And you better believe Prof is going to recap this. And we're going to make this a bread and butter presentation, this unusual presentation of pyelo. It's going to be like, oh, how could it be anything other than pyelo? But doctor, our nurse practitioner, provider, the patient doesn't have flank pain. The patient doesn't have Rigors. When this scenario builds up after we do our reading, it could be one thing, and that's pyelo.
Yeah. Although I think the comment that you made earlier, I didn't reflect on, which is like wondering what her chronic illness relates to how her immune system responds, relates to how she senses and reports that. Like that I actually didn't get into because it didn't cross my mind. But now I'm excited to read more about, like, is there a connection there that also contributes to her presentation? You know? Yeah, because you can get like complete bone marrow replacement and fatty atrophy in really bad cases of eating disorders. Anyway.
That's a wrap, folks.
Clinical Problem Solvers, we hope you enjoyed that episode. Each week, Robbie and I record an unknown case. A week later, we reflect on that case, trying to improve our diagnostic skills. Additionally, we upload 1 to 3 videos and teaching figures related to the case. Because the growth doesn't happen during the case. The growth happens reflecting on the case. Join us on rlrcpsolvers.com and let's go on this epic growth journey together.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. Robbie John. What an incredible case you presented. Why I love this case so much is that it was an uncommon presentation of a common illness. And the story was a young woman with anorexia nervosa who presented with fever, fatigue, myalgia, didn't have any urinary symptoms, and ultimately was diagnosed with acute bilateral pyelonephritis with proteus bacteremia. In order to really dissect this case, we got to start at the anorexia nervosa. Now, on our website, there will be a recording, comprehensive recording of anorexia nervosa. I had actually recorded it, just listened to it. Unfortunately, the quality of the audio is so poor that I am going to have to re-record it, but I'm going to do that. But here's the highlight. I want to emphasize that half the mortality rate in anorexia nervosa is due to a medical complication. And I want to discuss why patients with anorexia nervosa are at very high risk of delay in infectious-related diagnoses. The medical complications. When a patient is diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, they are in an extreme caloric deficit. They really don't have any energy to waste. And this results in two primary physiologic responses. One is the body enters a state of catabolism, attempting to free up calories for the brain to consume. Literally, it will start metabolizing heart tissue if the caloric deficit is severe enough. Secondly, the body does its best to not waste an ounce of energy. It really has to preserve the energy stores that it has. What does this result in? Everything is decreased. The heart rate is decreased. The cardiac output can be decreased because literally you're losing ventricular myocytes, that thickness of the left ventricle. They can have low blood pressure. They can have, their bones are thin. They can have osteoporosis. They may not be able to take regular breaths because of weakening of the respiratory muscles. Oropharyngeal dysphagia may lead to aspiration. Decreased gastrointestinal motility may lead to constipation and gastroparesis. The bone marrow is not as robust, with decreased cell counts, red blood cells, white blood cells, and even platelets. The creatinine is low because the muscle mass is low, and it's unlikely to reflect their actual kidney function. And of course, they can have electrolyte derangements as well. Why is there often a delay in diagnoses of infectious-related illnesses? For three reasons. One, they often don't have the classic symptoms that you would expect. I hypothesize, though I'm not sure, this is due to decreased nerve health. Maybe the neurons aren't firing as effectively, and therefore they can't sense the pain to then communicate to the provider. And two, they may not mount an immune response. Like a normal heart rate may be abnormally high in someone with anorexia nervosa, or they might not mount a febrile response due to an infection. And third, about a third of patients with anorexia nervosa who present to the hospital may be unconscious or lack the ability to communicate the symptoms that they have. So if we take all this learning and apply it to the case that Robbie presented, when he said fever and said the patient has anorexia nervosa, I would have said, Robbie, we have to be really cautious with diagnosing infections in such patients because they may not have the classic symptoms that we're expecting. So what this does for me as a diagnostician, it lowers my threshold to pursue invasive imaging to try to diagnose a site of an infection. And at time point zero, we think of respiratory checks, skin and soft tissue, GI, urinary, and bacteremia without a source. So in such a patient, I would have said, you know, I have a very low threshold to get the UA and to get the chest x-ray. Before this episode, I always thought you got to have some kind of urinary symptoms to blame the urinary tract on the inflammation. But this episode changed that. And let me tell you why. It's not only because the patients with anorexia nervosa may not have symptoms, but let's talk a little bit about acute pyelonephritis. acute pyelonephritis. Pyelo means renal pelvis. Nephritis, neph means kidney. Itis means inflammation. So this is inflammation of the renal pelvis and the kidney parenchyma. But it doesn't do the disease justice, because most often the disease occurs because bacteria ascend up the urethra and make their way up to the kidney. So the entire urinary tract is inflamed, not just the kidney. And so most of these patients have bladder symptoms in addition to the flank pain, dysuria, urinary frequency, urgency. And that makes sense. The entire urinary tract is inflamed. There are other ways that you can get infection of the kidneys that's not through the urinary tract, rarely hematogenously. For example, Staph aureus bacteremia may lead to hematogenous seeding of that kidney, leading to pyelonephritis. But what I learned is that about 20% of patients with pyelo don't have bladder symptoms. About 10% don't have flank pain. Some don't have fever, and a good chunk, maybe up to 20%, have bilateral pyelonephritis. So you have to flex the illness script, especially in the vulnerable patient, like a patient with anorexia nervosa who may not have typical symptoms, or those who are elderly or have diabetes or who are immunocompromised. So knowing that, I would have said, hey, Robbie, she's young. Her immune system is probably compromised with her anorexia nervosa. She may not have the common symptoms. So if that UA is positive, I'm really concerned for a complicated urinary tract infection. Quick exercise. What urinary tract infections can lead to fever? Pyelo, of course. You can have a urinary cystitis that's then complicated by bacteremia that causes fever. Or in men, you can have acute prostatitis that presents with fever. So that's infection of the lower urinary tract. I used to think that simple cystitis doesn't cause fever, but it can. But if I do have fever and I'm worried about urinary tract infection, I'm thinking about these complicated urinary tract syndromes. As far as other organisms, besides E. coli is the most common organism to cause pyelo, especially in those who have healthcare, association, who have urinary catheters or urinary tract instrumentation or are immunocompromised. Other organisms you have to consider include Staph, Enterococci, Pseudomonas, and Candida. And the Staph, not just aureus, but also Saprophyticus. A clue to Enterococci and Staph is the nitrates are negative, but applying base rate of disease, even if the nitrates are negative on that UA, it's more likely to be an Enterobacteriaceae like E. coli, Proteus, or Klebsiella that just hasn't converted the nitrate to nitrite. The other thing I wanted to say is that there's a three-pronged approach to treatment of acute pyelo. Again, this video is on our website, and that's supportive care with IV fluids, analgesics, antipyretics if the patient's uncomfortable, antibiotics. And the antibiotics, you're going to target organisms like E. coli. It's important to know that E. coli resistance to fluoroquinolones like Cipro and levofloxacin and Bactrim is increasing in some places more than 10%. So you just got to be cautious with your choice of antibiotics. And third is source control. Now, this might not be relevant in all patients, but if your patient isn't getting better at 48 hours, ask the question, is there an issue with source control? And then you might have to do imaging to look for a renal abscess or necrotizing pyelonephritis, known as emphysematous pyelonephritis, or an obstruction causing hydronephrosis. Ultrasound is best for hydronephrosis. CT with contrast is best for abscess or necrotizing pyelonephritis. And non-con CT is best for a stone. I think that's all I wanted to talk about. Really interesting case, really humbled me, and very happy to have grown from this case and be better prepared for the next patient.